This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
By the end of the first day, I was like, and I write it in the book, we're like, what the hell are we doing? Like, we're doing everything. And they made us, it was like Paris Island boot camp of minor league baseball the very first day on the job. And I realized it was the hardest I was probably ever going to work, the least amount of money I was ever going to make. But looking back, it was the most fun I ever had.
Welcome into another episode of Baseball America's From Phenom to the Farm. I'm your host, Kyle Bandujo. This episode was a treat for me, and I'd like to think that it is something that every minor league baseball fan and college baseball fan will enjoy. Today, we are talking to Ryan McGee, ESPN senior writer and author of the new book, Welcome to the Circus of Baseball, story of the perfect summer at the perfect ballpark at the perfect time, which walks through his time as an intern for the Asheville Tourists in 1994. If you love minor league baseball, which if you're listening to the show, I would strong chance you do, you'll love this book. J.J. Cooper wrote a full review on the Baseball America site, and I'm going to echo that review. This book is an absolute delight. I have enjoyed reading it. I was a former minor league intern myself, which Ryan and I will talk about. But if you love minor league baseball, if you've even been to a minor league baseball game once before in your life, you're going to love this book. Had to have Ryan on to discuss it. We discuss his love for minor league baseball, which is something that really comes through in this book. We talk about the life of an intern, all the variety of duties and jobs that you have to do in that workplace, and we get one great story of one of the many colorful characters he met during his time in Asheville. Again, highly encourage you guys to pick up the book. It has been a lot of fun to dive into. However, we also get to do one of my other favorite things, which is talk college baseball, because Ryan has another book that is another one of my favorites, The Road to Omaha. Ryan chronicled the 2008 College World Series, which, if you remember, is where that underdog Fresno State team shocked the college baseball world, won a title. I cannot let Ryan leave the show without reminiscing about that time in Omaha as well. Again, another thing Ryan has a lot of passion for is the College World Series. He's there every year, and that year picked a great one to write a book on. Honestly, it is the closest that you can get to being in Omaha without booking the flight. So big fan. Again, that is the year, you know, Buster Posey's Golden Spikes year, that underdog Fresno State team. Great book. Great to reminisce on that 2008 College World Series. And with both of these books, if you're a baseball fan, if you're a BA reader, you'll like these books. Again, echoing JJ's review of Welcome to the Circus of Baseball. But we'll highly enjoy it. And I hope you enjoy this conversation with Ryan, because it was a real treat for me to have him on the show. Episodes are from Phenom to the Farm, drop every other Tuesday if you enjoy this one. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Go check out past interviews and tell a friend about the show. Also, make sure to subscribe to BaseballAmerica.com and the BA podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. The minor leagues are going, the big leagues are going, which means BA has the prospect hot sheet. College baseball coverage, college is in the thick of conference play, so be tuning in every week, checking out the projected field of 64 for, you know, to get to this year's College World Series. A lot of good stuff at BA, as always. Very good time to be a subscriber. And with that, let's talk to Ryan McGee. All right, joining me today on From Phenom to the Farm, he's a senior writer at ESPN, co-host of Marty and McGee, and author of the new book, Welcome to the Circus of Baseball, a story of the perfect summer at the perfect ballpark at the perfect time. It is Ryan McGee. Ryan, thank you so much for joining the show.
No, it's great to be here. It's fun talking to everyone about the book, but particularly someone like you that I know the minor leagues are near and dear to your heart. You're my people, Kyle, so I'm glad to talk to you.
Absolutely. And movie references, which the book is full of. So this has been a very.
I even called myself out at one point. Like, yeah, there might be too many movie references in this book, but that's cool.
No, I mean, love it. We've got a Roadhouse reference. Yeah. We've got some Batman. It's been great. I've been loving the book. I interned in the minor leagues. This has been just wonderful for me to experience in general. What made now the time to write about your first job out of college?
Well, I mean, honestly, they let me do it. You know, I've been pitching this book forever, and it was one of those things where just a confluence of events. I was asked a question. I was very fortunate to do a book with Dale Earnhardt Jr. a few years ago that did very well, not because of the and author, it was because of Dale Jr. But I was given the opportunity then, like, all right, what do you want to do next? And I wanted to do a book with my father about his days as a college football referee, which we wrote a couple of years ago, Sidelines and Bud Lines. And then after that, the question was in that same vein, I've always wanted to write these stories that, you know, bless my wife's heart, these stories that I've made her listen to for 20 years and all my friends have listened to for 20 plus years about my summer minor league baseball. And, you know, I love minor league baseball so much. I've been to 129 parks. I have a list I keep on my computer and I update it every summer. I book my travel around minor league baseball. My family, when I was a kid in the Carolinas, you know, we just look at a map. All right, we've never been to a game in Burlington. We've never been to a game in Kinston. We've never been to a game in, you know, Hickory. Let's go. And so I love it so much. And there are some great books about the minor leagues out there, but they're focused on players. And, you know, guys trying to move up the ladder or moving down the ladder, it's all very Bull Durham, right? I mean, it's all based on the players. And to me, the cast of characters, when I saw Bull Durham in the theater a long time ago, because I'm old, the characters that fascinated me were Millie, right? And, you know, and the old guy that did the terrible radio play-by-play guy and his analyst that never talked, did sound effects, who were those people? And so when I had a chance to work with those people, and they were real. I mean, we had our own cast of characters. Every ballpark has it. You know, everybody who's ever worked in the minor leagues knows a cast of characters like this. So, you know, it was me hopefully passionately pitching that, what I just said to you. And when I threw out a couple of who these characters were and some of the stories about that summer, thankfully my friends at AA said, let's give it a shot.
And I've got questions about some of the characters. I want everyone to read this and experience this book for themselves. So we don't want to spoil a lot of it, but I do have some questions. But just, you mentioned that, and it's early in the prologue of the book you're talking about, or just in one of the early chapters, you're talking about that you and your family went to a lot of minor league games. Now, you grew up, the Carolinas are Mecca for minor league baseball. Like, it is I talk to my wife all the time, we should just do a North Carolina minor league road trip. Where I live in Texas, it's much harder. You got, you know, my home city, and then everywhere else, you're driving multiple hours to get to a ballpark. But
state's too big. Y'all got a lot of teams too big. In Texas. State's too big. You know, they're so spread out, but I've been to most of them, but man, you got to really want to, you can't get from one to the other.
I would have to fly reasonably. I would probably fly to Amarillo and El Paso from where I live if I want to go to those ballparks. But with you growing, I mean, you are a big fan of the game of baseball. You've written about the minor leagues. You've written about college, which we're going to talk about with this episode. How much did big league baseball, the 32 teams, influence you as a child versus just having proximity to professional baseball versus the minor leagues? Because it's one thing with contraction, which is MLB has done, is gonna sure as hell try to do more of. How much of having that regional access to professional baseball influenced you to become a lifelong baseball fan and supporter of the game?
It's the only access we had, you know. You know, I grew up all over the North Carolina. If you ever listen to Marty McGee, I refer to hometowns 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We basically moved every, you know, 4 or 5 years, but I primarily grew up in the Triangle, you know, in Raleigh. And, you know, we had the Durham Bulls about 20 minutes away from where we lived in North, you know, Northwest Raleigh. The Carolina Mudcats moved to town at some point in Zebulon, you know, in the outskirts. They had to stay so far away from Durham. But if you wanted to go see the Braves, which were the closest major league team, that's an overnight trip. You know, you're driving all day and going to a game and spending the night. There's no coming back. And, you know, if you're going, the next closest team is probably the Orioles. The same thing. I mean, you're driving, you know, the length of Virginia and going to north of D.C. and going to a game. You're spending the night, and you're probably flying there. And so we were in a baseball house. I grew up a Red Sox fan. And the only reason I was a Red Sox fan was because my first T-ball team, when I was 5 years old, we all got in a single file line at the Shelby, you know, City Park, and they pulled hats out of a box. And I got a red hat with a blue B. I could have very easily been a Mariners fan or a Padres fan. It just was the hat that came out of the box. My dad was a Yankees fan because everyone his age, they were Yankee fans. And my brother became an Orioles fan, I think just because my dad and I loved the Yankees and the Red Sox. And so we loved Major League Baseball. And for you kids out there, this is kind of the dawn of cable. You know, I'm talking about the early to mid-1980s. And, you know, the Braves were on TV all the time. The Cubs were on TV all the time. That was it. You know, you had Monday Night Baseball. ESPN hadn't started doing the Sunday night game of the week yet. You had a Saturday afternoon game maybe on NBC. And that was kind of it. And so if you wanted to see professional baseball, even if it was at a high school stadium in Shelby, North Carolina, you know, living in Raleigh, we were a couple hours away from more than a dozen teams. And we could get there. And so, again, it kind of became collected. There was a book that had a huge influence on me. It was a book by a guy named Bob Wood that was written in the mid-80s, and it was called Dodger Dogs to Fenway Franks. And Bob was a middle school teacher living in, I think he was in Washington State, and picked one summer and spent the whole summer driving around the country and went to every major league ballpark. And in this book, it was this travel log, and it sounded amazing. You know, he's in like a Toyota Tercel, and he's got a Bob Seger Springsteen mixtape. And, you know, he's parking in KOA campgrounds, and he's going to major league games, and he would do report cards of the concessions and the parking and the scoreboard and, you know, what the seats were like. I loved that. And so my family would do that. We had no access to major league games. We would do that for minor league parks. And we would drive all the way down to Wilmington, North Carolina to see the Port City Roosters. And on the way back to Raleigh all night, we're grading out. All right, how was the hot dog? What kind of music did they play? Was the ballpark any good? And so that was a lifelong addiction that started as a kid, and it continues to this day.
I had a lot of those same similar feelings when I was growing up. And when I got into college, I had zero career plans, had no idea what I wanted to do. So, but yeah. I thought working in baseball would be cool. And like you, I interned only part-time because I was playing at the time in college, but I interned for Midland, interned for Salem in the Carolina League for a summer each. When you were going into the decision of I want to work in baseball, you graduated from Tennessee, you're down to the winter meetings, you're, you know, looking for that job, and the intern job at Asheville comes up, and how much did you know about job duties, what you were getting into working in baseball before you got boots on the ground?
I knew nothing. You know, I went down there wanting to be a radio play-by-play guy. So I went to the winter meetings in Atlanta. You know, I had all my resumes. I had all my cassette tapes.
The cassette tapes, right? I was like, man, that's a throwback.
Yeah, well, here in my office where I'm sitting, I still have a couple over here. It's got my name and my old phone number and landline phone number of my parents' house written on it. And I had done a little bit of high school football in Marshville, North Carolina, Forest Hills High School, hometown of Randy Travis, country music's finest. That's what the sign says as you pull into town. I did a little bit of color commentary for some small college football, and I went to games when I would sit up in the stands by myself and talk into a tape recorder and try to do reps, and that was suggested to me, you know, when I was in college by a couple of people. I took those cassette tapes and went to the winter meetings and thought I was going to land, you know, I was going to be the play-by-play voice of the Visalia Oaks, right, or the Rancho Cucamonga Quakes, whatever. Nobody wanted a guy with this accent in the 90s to be their baseball play-by-play guy. And so I had one maybe possibly job offer that was attached to radio but paid no money, and it was in Connecticut. And then I had a solid job offer from the Asheville Tourist, and it was the only real offer I had, and it was $100 a week, an internship. you're going to work in the front office. That was it. You know, they would put these manila envelopes on these bulletin boards and you would drop your resume in them. And they would have a job description and a pay scale. And the pay scale for everything was $100 a week, everywhere, no matter what the job was. Sales, if you're a sales guy making $100 a week plus commission, you know, it was a $100 a week internship in the front office. And it just said various duties. I think that's all it said. And I loved McCormick Field.
Various is used.
Yeah, various. It was every duty, right? But I loved McCormick Field. That was one of the places my family had gone to. We went to the old McCormick Field before they tore it down after the 91 season. We went to the new McCormick Field the following year. When I was commuting from the Carolinas to Knoxville for college, I used to stop in and go to tourist games all the time because I'd drive through Asheville. So I love the ballpark. I love the history. I love Asheville. Asheville's always been cool. It's super cool now, but back then it was still cool. And so I just took the gig, man. It's the only offer I had. So I took it, and literally by the end of the first day, I was like, and I write it in the book, we're like, what the hell are we doing? Like we're doing everything. And they made us, it was like Paris Island boot camp of minor league baseball the very first day on the job. And I realized it was the hardest I was probably ever going to work, the least amount of money I was ever going to make. But looking back, it was the most fun I ever had.
And the money per hour too, because it's long days and it's all dependent on the game too.
You can't do the math. If you do the math, then my dad always said this about his college football officiating career. You know, for years and years and years working small college games, and even when he first broke into the ACC in the 1980s, they'd make a couple hundred bucks a game. And if you put in all the study and the physical work and the workouts and the meetings and all that, you can't do the math. If you do the math, then you're going to be, you're going to be calling the labor department. You just want to just do your job and, get on with it. We were lucky to make $100 a week because, the internships I had in broadcasting paid $0. So to me, $100 a week, man, that was a bonus.
When we talk about the jobs, the duties, and you're a minor league, I mean, you're doing on-field games, yeah. Stuff that there's some skin in the game. Like if you mess up, people are going to see you, or it's consequential to business. You talk in the book about the ticket tearing, the stubs and having to make sure the right one. That just stressed me out. Yeah. Reading it, because I am absolutely the type of person to be like, oh, I've put the wrong part of the ticket in 20 straight times. We're in trouble here.
Well, it just everything felt like an audition, every single day. And then when I went on to work at ESPN, right after this job, every day felt like, my wife's an actress and she's constantly auditioning for TV parts and for stage parts. And I don't see how you do it. But every single day felt like that. Like you're exactly right. It was on you if it didn't work out. And, in the book, again, go back to my wife, bless her heart, I never throw anything away, which was great for the book, but bad if you're living with the guy. But I have the sheet they gave us on the first day that said, all right, there's basically three internship jobs you'll rotate out of. There's the front office, there's the ticket office, and then there's the concessions.
I was amazed in the picture section of the book having that sheet. Cause you get to the ballpark that day and there's your schedule. This is what you got to do.
But but you saw that everybody's got different duties for each job and there's different columns, but at the bottom of every position, whether you were the assistant general manager or the general manager or an intern, in bold print, all caps, TARP. So if there was any rain anywhere near anything, it was all hands on deck. No matter what you were wearing or what you were doing, you dropped it and you went and grabbed a loop and pulled the tarp.
We had, when I was in Salem, it was like 90s. I don't know. It was some, I can't remember what the theme was, but I didn't have anything for it. I ended up wearing America flag pants. Like,
of course you were.
Rex Kwando. Yeah. Yeah, of course.
You love America. Right.
And it starts pissing in the second inning. It's one of those games that you know is going to get banged before the fifth, but they're still trying to squeeze out as much beer sale as possible.
Yeah.
And I'm out there pulling tarp in these America pants that are soaked and stuck to my legs.
Yep.
And I mean, there is nothing worse than a tarp pull.
There's really nothing. And I write it in the book. And again, I've told you this, and the tarp pull is the perfect example. I felt a huge amount of responsibility with the book, as fun as it was, because I want to do right by the people. I did it for one summer, and I want to do right by the people who, my friends that have worked in baseball their entire life and pulled the tarp their entire adult life. You know, the Asheville Tourist, there was an intern 2 years later named Larry Hawkins. Larry never left. He'd been there since 96. He was an intern, and he's been the general manager, you know, now for years. And I want to do right by those people. And the TARP pool is a perfect example. You know, I had two near-death experiences with the TARP. You know, the mistake number one is once the TARP starts moving, it's moving. There's no stopping it. This is an unstoppable force. And your whole goal is to get momentum with probably not enough people. And once that TARP starts moving and the rain is starting to pick up and that TARP's getting heavier and heavier, you're just trying to get it to where it covers the infield and then get out of the way. Well, you can't slip and fall down. And I slipped and fell down or somewhere around the pitcher's mound. And it was like watching the roof close. And all I could think was I could hear the rain hitting that TARP above me as I'm laying on the, I'm starting to scramble on all fours, trying to get back to daylight. Cause once that TARP drops, all I could think was, it gets so heavy when it's covered with rainwater. I'm like, I'm going to die. Like they're going to come out here tomorrow morning and pull the TARP off the field and then pull my skeleton out of the ball.
There's going to be you and the raccoon that's been there for
exactly
3 weeks.
Yeah. And then me. And then the other part was the other sin was if the wind gets under the TARP, which it did for us. I mean, you know, summertime in the mountains, ballparks literally carved in the side of a mountain. The wind ricocheted off the mountain as we were coming across the field. And back then I weighed a 125 tops. And the wind got underneath that TARP and I took off. I always tell everybody, if you've ever ridden soaring at Disney World where your feet are dangling and you're flying over the Eiffel Tower, that's what it felt like. And in my mind, I was 45 feet up in the air. The reality was, you know, it was about 6 feet up. But folks, your feet are moving and they're not touching. It's like when you hold your dog over the bathtub and they start moving their legs, even though they know they're not going to be touching anything. That's exactly how I felt. And I crashed to the ground. So rule number one, don't fall down. Rule number two, let go of the loop before you go full Superman.
Yeah, you learn those tricks of the trade over the summer.
Yeah, but everybody in minor league baseball has TARP nightmares.
Oh,
and they
sure.
have TARP stories like that. And so that's the example of, I want to make sure that I tell my stories in a way that fairly represents them. And the cool thing is on social media, you know, is a love hate thing for everyone, but it's been awesome. All the people coming back with, oh man, one time the TARP did this. The Tennessee Smokies sent me a video of, they called it TARP NAMI, happened about 10 years ago. It's the greatest video I've ever seen. I've made my wife watch it 14 times on YouTube, but it's the example of, I mean, everybody has a story about when they almost died from the TARP, and I have too.
Oh, 100%. You mentioned this. There's like this fraternity of people who worked these entry-level jobs at minor league baseball. And like, I know for me and both of my stops, I think almost everyone who was on the kind of the entry level to up to the full-timers, like, you know, at Salem, like our full-time NC and stuff, most of those people have moved on from baseball and are doing something else, because those jobs that you're really looking at, you know, the GM, you want to be up in the front office, those are few and far between. When you get a good one, a lot of the times those people don't leave.
Right.
It is a tough industry to make it in, but what about that summer? What did you take from that job that has helped you have future success? Because I think, like, I think it's such a tough job. I feel like it's just such an important character building job, which sounds corny, but there is something about it that you don't get out of just working something else at an hourly wage, I think. And like we said before we started talking, like, we're on group text with people we work with for this job, for this minimum wage job for one summer.
Yeah, again, it's like boot camp, right? Or freshman year of college. You know, you're still in touch with the people probably that you went through those things with. And so that's how it feels. And to me, it has always helped me as a sports writer and as a reporter, because I feel like I kind of understand how stadium ops works, and I understand how logistics work. And I understand that, you know, if the Pepsi machine isn't working great in the press box, all right, sports writer guy, shut the hell up. Because what's happening now is this kid is trying to give you non-foamy soda, right? Or is trying to heat up the hot dogs in for your free press box meal. I've been there. I kind of know. And I laugh because when I go to the Jerry Dome or Mercedes-Benz Stadium or some brand new Major League ballpark, you know, working, I still feel a kinship to the stadium ops people and the concessions people and the logistics people and the security people. Although what they're working on a completely different planet and in a completely different level and in $1 billion stadium. I was working in a $3 million stadium 30 years ago, but I kind of I at least know what they do, right? And I kind of get it. And so it helps me cover sports because you understand logistics. I left ESPN for a few years and went to work for NASCAR, went to work for, the sanction body, for the league. And I always say it was not my favorite job. I'll be the first one to admit that. Everyone that worked with me knew that. But it helped me cover the sport when I went back to covering the sport because I kind of understood, you know, I might not agree with what they're doing, but I understand why they're doing the things they do. And so to me, that's it. I mean, it's character building and the stories are amazing, but it's also an understanding of, you know, there's the teams on the field. There are the fans in the stands. There are the people who are covering and commenting on the event. But if it wasn't for the people in the ballpark or in the stadium, none of it happens. None of it. And I think we kind of take a lot of those people for granted as sports fans.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you mentioned team on the field. And the funny thing about working, doing this job is a lot of the times you're not getting to see a lot of the game. You're busy running around, sweating bullets, trying to, trying to get the sing for your supper contest going and not watching the game. But I was looking, I went and looked at the 94 Sally League. Some names rolled through.
Yeah.
Roland, Maglio, Twins legend Shannon Stewart, Richie Sexson.
Yep.
We're going to talk about the concept of the pick here and when we talk the College World Series, but was there a guy that you were able to, and Baseball America around back then, they had the tabs on some of these guys. Was there a guy you were able to kind of step back and take a look at and take in, the beauty of minor league baseball, seeing these guys before they're stars?
Well, Roland came with all the pub, right? And Sexson did. But Jermaine Dye was at the Sally League All-Star game that year. And he was unheralded. And I remember seeing him play. He was good. I mean, you could just tell, and he was obviously several years away from being such a mainstay with the Braves as long as he was, but he's the one that I remember because just watch him in batting practice. And again, depending on what your job duty was that we're rotating in and out of, if you're doing concessions, you see none of the game, none of it. Mm-hmm. And the way McCormick Field is structured, the ballpark, the field itself kind of sits up on the hill and you go downstairs into this concourse that's lower than field level. And it's like a food court area kind of behind the ballpark. And so you see nothing, they're going to redo the ballpark in the next few years. And when they do, there's going to be a 360 degree concourse and you can get a hot dog and watch the game. But right now it's kind of two separate, ballparks. And so you're right. You didn't get to see much at all, but I remember Dye a lot. I mean, at the All-Star game, there was a lot of buzz about him. Our team was not great. People ask me all the time about the 94 tourists. We had four guys that made it to the big leagues for a minute. John Thompson was the only one that got anything close to a ring. He was a solid mid starter for the Braves, won a couple divisions. Jamie Wright was our nuclear loosh. Jamie was, he was a first round draft pick. The Colorado Rockies were brand new. We were an affiliate of the Rockies.
And he and Jared Wright are brothers, right?
No.
Braves, Jared Wright, they're not related?
No, they were. Okay. I think they were a little bit, they're related some way, but they're not brothers.
Think
so. You're going to make me, you're making me do my homework now.
I might have to Google. I think I always just loop them in together.
And that happens a lot. And it's funny with Jamie too, because I was doing an interview not too long ago and I said something about what Jamie Wright was probably, the most famous player on that team. And the reaction was, well, gosh, he won a couple of rings and this and that. No, he didn't at all. And, grew up in Oklahoma City, was a first-round draft pick, had a six-digit signing bonus. He was our bonus baby, and he was, one of the few. But I'm looking at it right now. Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Now, he pitched for more than 10 teams over the course of almost 20 years and almost was never he had to go to spring training and earn his spot. He just, he would sign a free agent deal and show up and do it. And he's a great guy, but struggled mentally, with how to do it, but pitching the big leagues for a long time. And the other one was Edgar Velasquez. And Edgar was one of about half a dozen guys from the islands that spoke no English. Officially, I think Edgar was listed as 18 or 19. There's no way that he was, but I remember he wallpapered his locker the first night with pictures of Roberto Clemente. And that's not surprising. He was from Puerto Rico. But about halfway through the season, Jack LeMay was our pitching coach. And Jack pitched in the big leagues for a long time, was on the 67 Cardinals team to beat the Red Sox in the World Series, famously lost game six as a reliever. And Bob Gibson says, don't worry about it. I won game seven. My wife needs a new car anyway. And a new car for winning the MVP. The next night, Bob Gibson, you know, won his third game, beat Jim Lomborg. Anyway, Jack LeMay goes, you know, that's Roberto Clemente's nephew. Talking about Edgar Velasquez. And his name was actually Edgar Clemente, but he changed his name because he didn't want special treatment. I will say this, a couple years later, he changed it back to Edgar Clemente, and he got called up to the Rockies like almost immediately. So he probably should have
should have kept it
with his name. But we had no stars. You know, there were no stars on that team. And to me, that's part of what makes that team special because, you know, if we'd had two or three guys that became, you know, went to Cooperstown, I don't know, maybe I'd have paid more attention to the team.
Yeah. And then, well, and then there's also more of the, I think there's awareness too, when that is the case, that there's a lot of, you know, hey, we're the 20 guys playing. So these couple can play. And yeah. I think with the team with less stars, there's less of that. So you've done an incredible job with the book in relaying this cast of characters that you encounter over the course of the summer. And I want everyone to experience that on their own reading this book, but it's in the prologue. So I have to ask about Captain Dynamite.
Oh yeah. No. And this excerpt is on the internet. I put it on a Twitter account. It's out there. Captain Dynamite is, quite frankly, you know, cause you're a writer, that got the book sold. You know, when I told the story of Captain Dynamite, Doubleday's like, we're in. So Captain Dynamite, this guy named Patrick O'Brien. If you look up Captain Dynamite on YouTube, there's actually a couple of local news stories where you can see Captain Dynamite in action. But Captain Dynamite at this point was in his early 70s, looked like he's about 145 years old, rolled up in a station wagon. He started unloading gear and we helped him carry the stuff out, and he had his exploding coffin of death. And what Captain Dynamite would do is he would build this coffin, and I'm putting it in air quotes. The coffin he used with us was like this foam board box that was painted black, but you could still kind of see the 3M insulation logo, you know, through the black paint. And so he puts this box out behind second base with the help of his wife and what I assumed were his grandkids, but I think might have actually been his kids. There's like a half a dozen of them running around. And they build this box and they pack it full of dynamite. Like Wile E. Coyote, like red sticks of dynamite, like TNT on the side of it, the whole thing. And they even had like the T-handle detonator, like Wile E. Coyote used to use to blow up bridges and stuff, like you see in the old movies. And so they connect these wires. And normally he would do this after games. Because it makes a mess. He did it prior to the game this day because we knew rain was coming and we wanted to get this in. It was a Sunday afternoon, like 1 o'clock game. So the captain lays down in this coffin, the coffin of death behind the same second base where Craig Biggio and Jackie Robinson played. And we all got down in the dugout and it's like a bunker. And I mentioned John Thompson, the pitcher for the Braves. The countdown starts from the PA announcers, 10, 9. And as the countdown starts, a player with the tour starts tapping on the shoulders and starts handing out batting helmets. And it was John Thompson. And he goes, y'all put these helmets on because some damn body parts are going to come flying into this dugout when this guy blows himself up. Got to 5-4-3-2-1. And and listen, I've covered motorsports my entire adult life. It's the loudest thing I've ever heard. It was so concussive. Like everyone reached up, you cover your ears and your eyes and like crap was falling out of the stands into the dugout and the whole thing. Well, when your eyes come to, there's a literal mushroom cloud, like rolling up from behind second base, a big white mushroom cloud, and crap is flying everywhere. All this plastic and foam and all that stuff, and it's all raining to the ground. Smoke clears up, and Captain Dynamite in his coverall green jumpsuit with his name sewn into the back and an old motorcycle helmet, he's just laying there, like not moving behind second base, like face down in the dirt. And that's when the very first sentence in the book, somebody yelled from the dugout, I think that some bitch is actually dead.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And so we're all like, and so we pause and the family goes running out there. And I don't know if the woman slapped him or gave him a shot of adrenaline or stuck smelling salts under his nose, but he kind of snapped too. And they helped him to his feet and the crowd started cheering. So now we got to clean up, right? We go running out onto the field. The team's waiting to play. And we start picking up foam and picking up all this stuff. And as I passed Captain Dynamite, he was leaving the field with his arm draped around his wife's shoulders, had blood running down from one of his ears. And I said, good job. And he kind of looked at me and kind of shrugged his shoulders. And she says to him, and she looks at him, she goes, he said, good job. And that's when I realized Captain Dynamite could not hear. And he looked at me. I realized one of his eyes was glass. He gave me a thumbs up. I realized he's missing fingers. I mean, you know, but that was his retirement year. We didn't know it at the time. We paid him $500 cash. He left, you know, game starts. And, that was his retirement year. And he was being replaced by his choice by a woman named Lady Dynamite. And Lady Dynamite was based down in Florida. And keep in mind now, y'all, this is the early 90s. Lady Dynamite had like a Evel Knievel, one piece swimsuit kind of a thing that was, you know, I write in the book, thong anchored is what I call it. It's Marty Smith's favorite line in the book. Had a cape and the whole thing, a big old head of 90s hair. And she did it for years. So, and she can't hear either. So yeah, Captain Dynamite, you can't make it up, man. And it's, and you know, this, the best part, you got the cast of characters that work at the ballpark. I say, you know, this, there's a poster from the Simpsons that have all these characters that are ever on the show. That's what the ballpark is like. Every ballpark's got a cast of characters like that. And then you have the kind of the visitors, right? You have the visiting entertainers, Elvis himself and Billy Bird and Bird Zirk and Myron Noodleman, you know, was kind of this Revenge of the Nerds guy that toured for 30 years. Max Patkin. I mean, you know, you can't make it up. It's why the minors are the best.
The best. And the book does an incredible job of bringing that all to life. So everyone go buy it. There will be links in the show notes for it. I do want to touch on before I let you get out of here, one of my favorite books coming up on the 15-year anniversary of this College World Series is The Road to Omaha. And you wrote about the 2008 College World Series, which notable for a couple of reasons. One, it's the only one I've ever been to. So that, I mean, that's what everyone knows.
That's big. Yeah, that's it. That's how we all
have been to. And then Fresno State is a 4 seed coming in and knocking off. Just with looking back at it today, 6 of the 8 teams are national seeds, which rarely ever happens now.
Nope. Yep.
And then Stanford also hosted a regional. So you have 7 regional hosts and 4 seed Fresno State.
Yep.
How did this book come about? Is it because of the Fresno State story? Was it predetermined? I've always kind of wondered because you have this great scope of the College World Series.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate you remembering the book. I always jokingly refer to it as, you know, I've written a New York Times bestseller, and I always say Road to Omaha was my New York Times worst seller. But that's also the kind of the little book that could, you know, every June when the College World Series rolls around, you know, the copies of that book would come to the office at ESPN for me to sign. And I get a little notice from Audible that people are downloading, you know, the audio version of the book. And with that, much like Welcome to the Circus of Baseball is a love letter to minor league baseball, The Road to Omaha is a love letter to Rosenblatt Stadium. And that's where it came from. You know, growing up in the Carolinas and in the Triangle in particular, you know, we would go to games, baseball games at NC State, in Chapel Hill, at Duke, down at Wake Forest. My father played college baseball at East Carolina. So we'd go down to Greenville. And so college baseball and minor league baseball were the two versions of baseball that I watched, and watching the College World Series on ESPN, watching Pete Incaviglia and watching, you know, the Grand Illusion play with Miami and watching Skip Bertman's LSU teams and Ben McDonald and all these, you know, those were in our house. We watched every game And we love the College World Series. And I got to go to, on a Father's Day weekend, I got to go with my dad finally to the College World Series. And like, I think my first one was 2001, and loved Rosenblatt Stadium. Rosenblatt Stadium was everything I wanted it to be and more. It was just still one of my favorite places on earth was that ballpark.
It was perfect.
And I went back a couple more times with my father, and it was becoming very obvious the ballpark was going to be closing soon. They were going to build a new ballpark. Quite honestly, kind of like McCormick Field, it was time to do something new. Rosenblatt was great until it rained, and then you realize there was nowhere to go and nowhere to hide, and everybody got wet. That was the pitch. The pitch was, we have to write this book now because Rosenblatt Stadium is going to go away. And I got the green light from St. Martin's Press. I found an agent who believed in it, and I just went out there, and I told ESPN, listen, I'm going to be there. If you want me to cover this thing for ESPN.com, I'll do it. But I'm going to work on this book. And, you know, I went and dove back into Feinstein books and you know, these behind the scenes books that also told the history of the event. And, you know, caught lightning in a bottle with Fresno. And you think about it. I mean, Buster Posey was there with Florida State. That Miami team was a machine. We had LSU there. You know, Georgia was another Cinderella team that should have won that College World Series, by the way. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
they seemed like Thanos in that College World Series.
They blew it and they know it. And Dave Perno, who was the head coach, you know, unbelievably that fall sat with me and we watched game two when they should have won the World Series and lost it. But that Fresno team was lightning in a bottle, man. And it was, you know, Gordon Beckham been hitting home runs all year for Georgia, and somehow Fresno with a bunch of guys we'd never heard of won that thing. And it's one of the greatest stories in college sports, but certainly in college baseball. And yeah, it was an opportunity to do that. And it was, again, a love letter. And then that very year, the official announcement was made. When I got there to cover that College World Series for the book, you know, the first artist renderings were on the wall for what the new ballpark would look like downtown. And they had a ribbon cutting ceremony and the whole thing. And I caught the city at a very divided time. You know, the locals didn't want a new ballpark. Mayor Fahey is really the guy that saved the College World Series, but became a pariah because the city blamed him for losing Rosenblatt. But it's a love letter to that ballpark is what it is. And when I go back there now, I go back every year for ESPN.com. And every year I have a different coworker who's never been there before. And I give them the Ryan McGee, this is where Rosenblatt Stadium used to be, historical tour. And so if you come out there and I'm out there, let me know and I'll put you in a rental car. We'll go take a ride up the hill.
I mean, it's such a fun book. I love revisiting it because it is a throwback to that time. And it is such a cool College World Series.
Yeah.
You're going in with the idea of, right, you're going to write this book.
Yeah.
And you've got these powerhouses and this four seed. As you're going in, did you have kind of a hope of how you thought things or how you wanted things to turn out? Did you have a dream matchup at the end? Did you want need the underdog in? But I mean, there's so many you mentioned in the book, Mike Martin and Jim Morris don't like each other.
Right.
A great chapter on the prestige. I mean, Posey was a special prospect, amateur.
To this day, I've never seen anyone in batting practice like that. The closest I've seen to that was I saw Bryce Harper when he was a rookie with the Nationals. I knew Drew Storen a little bit, who was a relief pitcher for the Nationals. He's like, dude, you have to go watch Harper hit right now. But Buster Posey, I've still never seen anything like that. That batting practice, the exhibition he put on at Rosenblatt.
There, Alonzo was a first-round pick. Yep. Beckham's a first-round pick. Ackley goes 1-2 the next year. But it's so interesting how focused everything was on Posey and what he was and who he was. I think the character helps, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's always a guy, you know. And back then, you know, the draft took place – Ben McDonald has become a great friend and is a coworker to ESPN. And he and I worked the College World Series, every year. And Ben was kind of that original guy. You know, the draft used to happen on top of the College World Series. You know, Scott Rowland tells a story about, he was walking, to his first at bat and they called him back to the dugout. Hey, dude, you just were just drafted. And so it's crazy. Kyle Peterson, you know, the voice of the Kirk Herbstreit of college baseball, mm-hmm. KP always tells a story about it. He was from Omaha, and he was helped shagging flies getting ready for a game, and they called him into the dugout. I go, hey, man, you just got drafted by the Brewers. And so the draft would happen, and so there was always a guy going in, still is, where all the focus is on, you know, this guy is going to be the next great superstar. Because you think about, you know, I mean, gosh, the Barry Bonds and, you know, I mean, all those players from USC back in the day, and it's just, you know, it's just player, Barry Larkin, player after player after player after player that we saw, Robin Ventura, who went on to these great major league careers. But there's always one that's kind of earmarked as that's the guy you got to talk to and that's the guy you got to get. And that's exactly who Buster Posey was. But yeah, so it's interesting with those things because I asked about the matchup. Quite frankly, for book sales, it would have been a lot better for me, you know, had Texas and Miami played in the finals, right? Mm-hmm. But as it turns out, you know, a Fresno Georgia final. Georgia is not exactly a baseball powerhouse, though they did win one. It should have won another one, and Fresno was Fresno. But storytelling wise, Fresno was the perfect story. And mm-hmm. and quite frankly, too, I had access to Fresno that I didn't have with some teams because they, I don't think they expected to be there for very long. So yeah, you kind of go in thinking, all right, this is probably what we're going to get. Man, if we'd had a Miami Florida State final, now I can write about, you know, wide right and two coaches don't like each other and all that stuff. It would have been, you know, Alonzo and you know, Buster, it would have been amazing. But I'm not going to complain about the amazing storyline we got. And again, you know, the book is about that series and how college baseball works. But it's also, I love Omaha so much. I love the city. I love Rosenblatt Stadium, obviously. You know, again, like Welcome to the Circus of Baseball. It's a love letter to what is my favorite event to cover, which is College World Series.
Mm-hmm. There's two things I want to ask you about. One is unique to college sports some, and then one is specifically unique to the College World Series. Is with college sports, and especially like Omaha, you're covering losing team, you're covering sad kids versus grown professionals, say in a Major League Baseball playoffs or something like that. Losing early in the College World Series is a killer. Because you're riding uphill, you're emptying out the bullpen. The something that always is the chapter about Tony Delmonico, essentially, and that tough Florida State loss. They're amateurs, everything's so fleeting. You might not have a dog in the fight, but you don't want some kid to be the GOAT either in these, you know, in situations like that. It's the last meaningful game a lot of these guys will ever play when they lose. When every press conference, you've got pictures in the book of, you know, Alonzo after his last game, the guy from LSU walking the field after their last game. How do you handle that with kid gloves when you're talking to these guys after the game, when it's just, it's not that they've lost a baseball game. It's just a chapter of their life has closed. That is, I've been there. It's devastating on any level.
Yeah, well, and I appreciate you making note of that, because it's something that I preach to my coworkers all the time, which is, hey, keep in mind now, that's the last time that guy's ever going to do this. That's the last time that woman's ever going to play basketball. That's the last time that these athletes, when they're eliminated from these tournaments, particularly in a championship game, you know, mm-hmm. yeah, there's particularly when I'm covering the college football playoff or I'm covering the College World Series, there are athletes in those games that are going to go on to bigger things. Most of them are not. Like the overwhelming majority of them are not. You know, there's only one Bryce Young playing for Alabama. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of guys on that Alabama football team that are going to play in the NFL. But the reality is, even as good as they are, two-thirds of them are not. They're done when their last college football game is over with. And so it's something I've always been really sensitive to. And I tell you, it changes when you're a parent too. You know, I've got an 18-year-old daughter, and I think about, you know, she may or may not have just done her last ever musical on stage. You know, it's chapters that you close. And for most of us, who weren't good enough to play at the next level or perform at the next level, whatever, you kind of know the end is coming. My last track meet was my last track meet. I knew it. I knew it at the time, and it was sad or whatever, but I had other things I was going to do. If your entire life has been geared toward you're going to play for the Yankees and now your baseball career is over, you talk about LSU, Michael Hollander was this player that I write about in the book for LSU that year in 2008. And all that kid wanted to do his entire life was play baseball for LSU. and he wanted to win a College World Series for LSU. And LSU was kind of coming out of a funk. You know, Palmieri had just gotten a job, and they finally gotten back to the College World Series. And in the cruelest stroke, the last out happens, the eliminating out happens in a play with Mike Hollander on the field. And he was the captain of that team. He was the heart of that team. And I saw him the following year playing in minor league baseball. And he's like, dude, this isn't the same. Like, he just, the wind was out of his sails. And so you're right. The key word's meaningful, what you said. It's the last meaningful game, mm-hmm. or the last meaningful at bat, or the last meaningful trip to the mound for all these guys. And so I try to be really, really sensitive to that. And when you're asking the questions, you need to be, it's one thing if you're interviewing a guy who plays for the Patriots, mm-hmm. right? Or if you're interviewing a guy who plays for the Astros, fine. You know, they're professionals. They know the deal. But when you're dealing with a kid, you know, then you need to remember that it's still a kid.
Yeah. We had Yonder on this podcast, a year ago, maybe 2 years ago. And he says that he didn't play in another game that had the same kind of intensity as yep. these games for Miami until he got to the MLB playoffs, which was a full yep. decade later when he yep. played one series for the Guardians.
And when you knew his story, you know,
yeah,
you know, they're
writing
the book,
story.
You know, what his parents sacrificed and, you know, and coming to the country and did everything in the world in their power just to make sure that he would have something better. That's why he was crying. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why I took that picture that's in the book. That's why he's so upset. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, and he said it that day, he said, this isn't even so much about me not playing for Miami anymore. It's me coming up short and feeling like I haven't paid off, you know, this hard work that my parents have put in. And of course his parents didn't feel that way, but that's how you feel, you know, when you're a kid. But the big thing is, and I say this all the time, it's different, and NIL, transfer portal, whatever, it's still college. Mm-hmm. It's still, you know, it's still college sports, and they're still kids. And, you know, I got a teenage daughter who's going to be leaving for school soon. And this made me think about that even more, which is, you know, I don't know how you were when I went off to college, man. I knew nothing.
I was clueless.
We talk about Jamie Wright not knowing how to cook. I didn't know how to cook. I didn't know how to do laundry. I didn't know how to do anything. And I can't imagine, you know, especially now when all these freshmen are playing all the time, I can't imagine being on that stage in those situations. And then when your heart is broken, you know, you got some 50-something-year-old sports writer standing there asking how you feel.
The last thing I want to talk about, and this is both from a covering the College World Series aspect and just if you want to go and be a fan, Chapter 9 of the book is the grind. And the College World Series is unique to pretty much any other sporting event or championship series. Like your college football playoff, that's two games, you know, built yep. over the course of a couple weeks. Your March Madness, you know, it's two games here, week rest, two games here, and then your Final Four, two games. The College World Series is long. There's almost always weather in Omaha. That College World Series in particular, I remember, I think was a game, North Carolina, there was a game where me and all my teammates who were there watching, the rain hits, bunch of us run for cover. One guy runs under the tarp. They had pulled over the tarp into the stands with a couple fans, and that game went late because he was the only one who stayed. But it is a grind to cover, to play in it, and it makes games weird. Teams have to dip into unsung heroes. When you're covering this, what is the endurance factor of, like, I have to find a way to get a grasp on everything that's happening and get a read on these teams and feel like, Who is feeling inevitable? Who is able to weather these storms? And you have to weather them yourself as a writer.
Yeah, that's the thing, is you're just tired, man. It's just, you know, you're just exhausted. I'm a big fan of Survivor, you know, the reality show. And I've over the years, I've talked to several people that were on the show, and they all say that you're so tired that you're just trying to, you don't even understand what Jeff's saying. All right, we're going to do this in this game and you got to do this, that you don't even understand what the hell he's saying. You just do it and whatever. That's kind of where you get when you've been there for the grind. So back then I would stay for the whole 2 weeks, and people who will complain to me about why is ESPN wanting to compress the College World Series. And I have no problem with the pitch clock, and it's coming to college baseball, which I think is great. Mm-hmm. And it'll help with the transition going forward. Games are too long. You know, that's part of the problem too, is that you play two games in one day in Omaha and they each last 4.5 hours because they're overmanaged. They are, you know, I love college baseball, but calling every pitch from the dugout is insanity.
It drives me crazy.
And the pro coaches would rather the guys have called their, the pitchers would rather call their own pitches. But anyway, all that being said, yeah, you're just exhausted. And back in the day, I would be there for the whole 2 weeks. Now I'm the jerk. Now I'm the guy that, you know, the people who cover college baseball full time, the legends, you know, they've all been in the press box for a week, and I come parachuting in usually for essentially the semifinals. I usually come in when there's, you know, four teams left and for the championship series. And I'm the guy like, hey, boys, let's go out, right? Let's go to the Drover. And they're like, it's all middle fingers as far as I can see, because, you know, I used to be right there with them. And now I'm the guy that comes parachuting in, you know, like I've been drinking Red Bulls, I'm ready to go. But it's hard, you know. It's and it's just a very, very different. You're kind of in the bunker, you know. I've never been a beat writer, so I've never, you know, a baseball beat writer that's on the road with the team all the time, and they're just grinding all the time. Or even if you're covering an NFL team and you got to crank out content every single day, you know. When I cover college football, I certainly experience a little bit of that. But there are at least a few days off in Omaha. You know, there are no days off, and I can tell you, kind of to your point about when I was writing the book, you want the best matchup and you would love for the championship series to go to three games every year because it'd be a great story. But no one in the press box is heart is broken. When it didn't bother anyone in the press box last year that Ole Miss won it in two games and we got that third day off because everybody's flights for the next day. There's a lot of adult beverages consumed on that third day if a game isn't played. And it being Ole Miss was neither here nor there. It could have been Oklahoma too. Just the people in the press box at that point are ready to chill.
Yeah, and with how college baseball functions, with every team during the regular season, the goal is win your three game series, and suddenly Omaha and conference championship stretch out. Yeah. I always joke, my wife went to TCU, and so we're big TCU baseball fans. We always kind of joke that the Big 12 championship game is usually a duel between like which team has the best guy who threw three innings this year. The end of the bracket, the bracket championship games in the College World Series are like that too. You literally have to have an unsung hero.
Well, and what happened with Fresno that year was, you know, back in the days of the WAC, and this was the WAC that was so spread out. You know, it ran from Hawaii all the way to Louisiana Tech, and you know they've played four game series. They would go on a Thursday, and would play through Sunday, or they play a doubleheader in between. But they'd always play a four-game series because they were all traveling so much. They're like, we can't always play a Tuesday game, so we're going to play four every weekend. And I remember the light coming on for me. I think I wrote it in the book when all of a sudden I realized everybody else is trying to figure out, well, how are we going to do this with a third pitcher, a fourth pitcher, whatever. Fresno been doing it all year because of the craziness of what was the WAC schedule, but the fact that they were playing four-game series. You know, they didn't just have the Friday, Saturday, Sunday starter. They had the Friday, Saturday, Saturday, Sunday starter. And so they already knew how to go deep. And so in the dugout. So it was an interesting, it kind of played to their advantage, which I don't think anybody realized until it happened.
Mm-hmm. Even with Tanner Shepherd's going down. I mean, I encourage everyone to go back and look at the book, but it's such a incredible underdog story because they had one guy, they had a dude, they had their pick, and Tanner Shepherd goes down. He doesn't even play in that postseason. Incredible. So both the books, everyone go check them out. But I want to leave you with this. I ask every player who comes on the show, give yourself a pep talk, you know, right before you get drafted or whatever. Go back and give yourself a pep talk at 22, right before you walk into Asheville. What would that pep talk look like?
The pep talk would be, hey, man, you are a really skinny dude. You are not physically cut out to change 52 kegs in a beer cooler one night on a Thursday, Thursday. You are not physically cut out to be pulling a tarp that's thousands and thousands of square footage of plastic and polyurethane. You are not physically cut out to carry endless boxes of souvenir cups down to the storage area. You're not physically cut out to separate drunks who were fighting in the grandstand on a Thursday, Thursday. But you know what, dude? You can do it. And who knows? By the end of the summer, you might be physically fit to do all of it. You might be mentally fit to do all of it. And I'd also tell that kid that you know this, the book opens with me bombing my interview at ESPN and them saying, if you've not heard from us within 365 days of today, we're never calling. And I would tell that kid that summer, hey, man, hang on, because on the 362nd day, they're going to call you. So that's probably what I'd let him know.
That'd be a good one. That'd be a good one. Little rapid fire for you, then I'll let you get out of here. What's worse, the morning Kids Day game or extra innings?
Extra innings. Yeah. And extra innings always happen on fireworks night.
Always, of course.
If there's fireworks night, you're going 12 innings, and it was always a nightmare.
Old concession stand chicken fingers or old concession stand hot dog?
Hot dog, all day long. Chicken fingers are questionable.
Favorite minor league ballpark?
I mean, I got to say McCormick Field, just because that's – so I'll give you three. McCormick Field, and because I wrote a book about it.
Mm-hmm.
Truist Field in Charlotte, because that's where I'm a season ticket holder. But if my built-in favoritisms notwithstanding, it is difficult to top being in Toledo in what I still call the new ballpark, the way they incorporate those old warehouses and watching the most classic minor league team that there has ever been, ever will be, and that's the Mud Hens.
Getting to Charlotte is a must for me. Every picture of that skyline of the stadium is incredible.
My wife, again, I drive my wife crazy with all this stuff, but she's like, how many pictures on your camera roll are of the skyline from the ballpark? And I'm like, probably 2/3 of them. And you know what? Next week is a homestand, and I'll be taking another 40 of them.
It's perfection. College ballpark you haven't been to yet and would like to?
I have never been to a game at Arkansas. I've been in the ballpark empty in the fall when I was there for football, but I've never been to I've been to Ole Miss, I've been to Mississippi State, I've been to the Box, I've been to South Carolina, I've been almost everywhere in the SEC, but I've never been to a game at Arkansas, and I'm told that atmosphere is way underrated.
Seems like it on TV. Last question. I always like to get a food question in. Best barbecue in North Carolina.
All right, so you know this, there's the Eastern North Carolina deal versus the Western North Carolina deal. And for you people out there that don't know, Eastern North Carolina is vinegar-based, which sounds gross to a lot of people, but it's not. And then Western North Carolina is tomato-based. But I'm a Lexington barbecue guy, because Lexington to me is kind of a punt, because you have a vinegar-based barbecue, but you can also put a tomato-based sauce on it. And every year at Christmas, my brother, he says he's profiling people. He wants to see who's who. He'll put out both kinds of barbecue, and just to make him mad, I'll mix the two of them. But I'm old school. Give me Lexington barbecue, and it's hard to beat the OG, and that's the OG.
That is perfect. Perfect. Ryan, that is all I've got for you. Everyone, go check out Welcome to the Circus of Baseball, a story of the perfect summer at the perfect ballpark at the perfect time. Ryan, thank you so much for joining from Phenom to the Farm.
Hey, thank you. And I, like I said, I got a daughter going to college in the fall, so I need y'all to buy this book. So
Everyone, go do it. I couldn't recommend it high enough.
I appreciate that. And you're in my target audience. So if you like it, then I think I'm in the ballpark.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Ryan. I appreciate it.
Thank you, bud.
And that's it for today's episode. Huge thanks to Ryan McGee for stopping by, walking me through his new book, his time as a minor league baseball intern, and of course, the 2008 College World Series. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe wherever you get your podcast. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.